Now, inflation is kind of special because one of the economic effects of inflation is that it tends to make people less averse to taking on debt. The idea is if you have a fixed amount that you're promising to repay in the future and you expect more inflation going forward, then the real value of what you promise to repay, it's not going to be quite so large because in the future, $1,000 isn't going to have the same purchasing power as it does today.
It's easy to say that when you have that feeling of being able to spend more, that's when the potential for the concern around higher levels of debt and potential bankruptcy pops up.
Welcome to The Ripple Effect, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the minds of Wharton faculty. I'm your host, Dan Loney, and in each episode, we'll be diving deep into the inspiration behind the groundbreaking research that Wharton professors have conducted and exploring how their findings resonate with the world today.
Well, programs like Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, and others provide an important safety net for families. But how do these programs impact the concern around household debt? Having those programs may deter people from savings as much as they probably should. Sasha Indarte is an assistant professor of finance here at the Wharton School. She has taken a deeper dive into this, and she joins us here in studio. Nice to see you. Thanks for a few moments today. You know, this is an interesting topic, I guess, especially because people don't necessarily associate the availability of these types of programs to still being able to put away savings.
I agree. I think it's not usually the first thing that comes to people's mind when you think about the social safety net. How is that going to impact people's borrowing? But it turns out from my research, it looks like those programs can have a really large interaction with credit markets and actually a really big part of the social welfare benefits from these programs can actually work through credit markets.
So take us through the research, because part of it, you did some research about the impact of Medicaid and the number of people eligible in a particular area can have a direct impact on the usage of things like credit cards.
Right. So in a recent working paper with my co-author, fellow Wharton professor Gideon Bornstein, we study the impact of expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act on consumers' use of credit card debt in particular. Now, it's not obvious from economic theory what you would expect. You could get less credit card debt, less debt overall, and perhaps even more savings if, for example, people, when they fall sick, if they now have insurance, they might not need to borrow or to draw down their savings in order to afford the cost of that care. Now, on the other hand, people might have a less of a, what we would call in economics, a precautionary savings motive. This is the idea that you use your own savings, you build up wealth in order to insure yourself against adverse events like job loss or illness in this case. And then finally, credit supply might also react to how people's behavior changes after Medicaid expands. In particular, if people now have insurance and they default less often, they're in a sense more financially resilient, and creditors might be more willing to lend to them.
In terms of, you know, people feeling like Medicaid, it helps them feel like they're probably more free to be able to spend in other areas, right?
Exactly. So this is this precautionary savings piece of people's behavior. If you're going to be able to rely on Medicaid when you become sick, you might have a little bit more leeway to spend even outside of times when you're not necessarily sick, because you don't need to self-insure that much with your own savings.
And then so also speak to the component about how social insurance programs can actually help creditors as well.
Exactly. So when people get access to insurance, we see, for example, in our own research, people become less likely to default overall. In particular, they are less likely to have debt in collections, which is one of the worst things that you can have on your credit report. So this reduction in default, that's going to make creditors more likely, we find, to approve requests for credit cards. People will see an increase in their credit limits. Essentially, the supply of credit is reacting to people's improved financial resilience.
So those creditors feel more amenable to being able to provide these assets to those members of the public.
That's exactly the idea.
That's interesting, because doesn't that kind of open a door? They're basically opening the door to the potential problems that we're talking about here with some of the issues of household debt.
Yes. So in our paper, we see things running in one particular direction overall. We see that Medicaid expands, it's overall reducing default, people's credit scores improve, and despite taking on more debt, their financial capacity, their ability to tolerate having a lot of debt, that's also improving as a result. But if you did have an expansion in credit without these improvements to people's financial resilience, that's when I would be especially worried about the burden that that debt imposes.
So is this somewhat similar to maybe what we're hearing now about people relying on their credit cards in some cases because of the level of inflation? They may not have as much money in the bank as they would like to, so they're using credit cards to replace that.
This could be part of what we're seeing recently with credit cards. Now, inflation is kind of special because one of the economic effects of inflation is that it tends to make people less averse to taking on debt. The idea is if you have a fixed amount that you're promising to repay in the future and you expect more inflation going forward, then the real value of what you promise to repay, it's not going to be quite so large because in the future, $1,000 isn't going to have the same purchasing power as it does today.
It's easy to say that when you have that feeling of being able to spend more, that's when the potential for the concern around higher levels of debt and potential bankruptcy pops up.
It's hard to say whether people's financial resilience is necessarily going to be worse overall. That's really the key thing to understand whether or not an expansion of credit is going to be a good or bad thing. So is inflation really helping people to the extent that they maybe anticipate that it will in terms of making their debt affordable?
How much is the burden of debt that people carry directly tied to not having the cash on hand?
That can be an enormous burden. So if you do not have the cash to afford your debt payments, typically people, they then go delinquent. So they start to miss some of their payments. And that debt, it can continue to build up over time. Some types of debt, for example, like credit card debt, it can continue to build interest. So the overall burden can grow. And then when people are finding themselves with an overwhelming amount of debt, that's when they might seek something like debt relief through bankruptcy.
But I also noticed you have looked at, in the past, the level of bankruptcy and how it's tied to bias within the public as well.
Yes. So I have some ongoing research that tries to both document and understand the reason behind racial disparities and the access to the debt relief that bankruptcy provides.
Where did that start from? Where did that genesis start from in terms of wanting to look at that?
So there were really two big motivating factors. The first is that bankruptcy is an important source of debt relief for U.S. households. In fact, if you actually compare the scale of the wealth transfers in terms of the debt forgiveness that bankruptcy gives people, if you compare that to other social insurance programs, it's bigger than a lot of them. It's on par with programs like unemployment insurance or even larger in most of the years of unemployment insurance. The second motivating factor beyond the importance of bankruptcy is that there's a big body of financial research that finds that there's a lot of racial disparities in financial market outcomes. So we wanted to see, is bankruptcy also one of these areas where you also see racial disparities?
And there was more of an impact on Black Americans than there would be in regards to white Americans as well, correct?
Exactly. So we found, for example, that now there's two different types of bankruptcy chapters. About 70% of people file Chapter 7. Now in that chapter, Black filers are about 3 percentage points more likely to be dismissed. That might not sound like a lot, but there's not a lot of dismissal. That means you go through all the trouble of the bankruptcy process, but then you don't get your case is thrown out. You don't get the one good part of the bankruptcy, which is the debt relief. And that's about double the baseline rate for non-Black filers. Now, in Chapter 13, we see an even larger in absolute terms disparity. In Chapter 13, Black filers are about 16 to 17 percentage points more likely to have their case dismissed, which gives them about a 20% relatively higher rate of dismissal.
But can we determine why the numbers are the way they are in terms of Black filers versus white filers?
It's really difficult to get at this. So we have to use a clever bit of econometrics in order to try and say something about bias. Now, the reason that it's challenging is when you see a disparity, this could be due to unobserved variables that we're not controlling for. For example, if Black filers have a greater risk of losing their job in the future, that could make it hard for them to complete some of the requirements in Chapter 13, and that might explain some of the disparities. So it could just be these unobservable non-controlled for characteristics,
right,
versus actual bias. So the crux of our approach to overcome this is we look at differences in the Black-white dismissal gap among Black decision makers in the bankruptcy process. These would be the bankruptcy trustees versus white decision makers in the process. And the idea is when we do this differencing and comparing, we can kind of net out these omitted factors, and what we're left with is how these two groups make decisions differently.
Right. But for Blacks that either file for Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 and they don't get approved to the level that they want to, that just adds another layer of angst for them in terms of trying to get out from under that level of debt.
Exactly. So when these black filers are not getting access to bankruptcy, this can have really negative economic and even health consequences. There's work by Will Dobie and his co-authors, for example, that finds that they exploit a really nice in a statistical sense, a natural experiment that led to some people receiving Chapter 13 debt relief, some people didn't get it. And what they found is that the ones who got the debt relief, they were more likely to be employed, they had higher income in the future, they were more likely to be homeowners in the future, and they even had improved mortality in the future. So if there's a disparity, a racial disparity in access to debt relief, there could be pretty far-reaching consequences from this.
Suffice it to say that the research that you've done on this topic shows that there are probably quite a few adjustments that could be made in terms of how this process goes, the structure of it, in order to kind of improve the process for all Americans, correct?
I see that. I think our research, what it does is it helps illuminate some areas where there's more room for investigation. I think it highlights possible avenues of policies or other changes that we could make if we want to improve and give more equal access to bankruptcy. This could be things like, for example, in Chapter 13, there's a lot more subjective decision making on the part of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy trustees. They have a really hard mathematical problem where they have to try and forecast a person's income over the next 5 years. So that can be a difficult task. And when there's subjectivity, there's more scope for bias potentially to influence how they handle cases. So trying to remove some of that subjectivity and maybe automating more parts of the bankruptcy process. That's one avenue that I can't say for sure it would work, but it would be useful for researchers to explore.
So is there a next natural step that you want to investigate in this process?
Yeah, I think investigating ways that introduce the use of algorithms, for example, to maybe aid in the decision-making process. This is something that's been done in other, more of the criminal areas of the law, where, for example, with respect to sentencing and things like that, and seeing if this is something that can reduce bias in bankruptcy, that would be useful for researchers to investigate.
Sasha, great to meet you. Thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sasha Indarte, who is Assistant Professor of Finance here at the Wharton School.
Thank you for listening to The Ripple Effect. We hope you found this episode informative and engaging. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review so that we can continue to bring you the best insight from the Wharton School.